speak. I have a recorded interview with Dr. Samuel Nadelson at his home in Knoxville, Tennessee, on February 26, 1998. The interviewers are Dr. Myron Warshaw and James G. Trainum.
So we'll be spending a reasonable amount of time with you. So,
from what I have read, I think I've learned that you were born on February 28, 1909, in Brooklyn, was it?
Yes.
Can you tell me something about your early childhood, your family situation in Brooklyn?
Well, I was a consultant to the National Aeronautics and Space Administration. They had me investigated. And they came to me and said to me, "You have two birthdays, the February 27th, 1909, and February 28th, 1909. I said, "How did you get the first one?" They said, "We got it from your father's prayer book. He used to write in his prayer book the time and date that each child was born. And he had me down for February 27th. Well, it so happened that I must have been a difficult delivery, because the nurse who reported my birth at the hospital put down February 28th. So that's how I happen to have two birthdays.
Which one do you celebrate?
I usually put down February 28th because that's on my birth certificate. Now, I never found out why I had two birthdays, so I was never forgotten.
Well, did you attend public schools in Brooklyn?
Yes, I attended the public schools in Brooklyn.
And where did you go to high school? In Brooklyn?
In Brooklyn, at the Eastern District High School. It was a Class A high school for gifted children. We had the highest IQ in the school.
What was your father's business?
My father was, as he considered it, the only good business. He was a clock operator. You know what a clock operator was?
No.
That's the way he pronounced it.
No? Tell me.
He would design clothes and cut them out and then baste them together. And his lowest form of, he insulted anybody by calling him a basin puller. Someone who just pulled a basin. But and there's a famous poem, anti-Semitic poem, that was written by some anti-Semite. He said, "Rosenbaum, he was a fighter, but he fought for a sword he never drew. And he said, 'The hell with fighting, it's no business for a Jew. Butcher, baker, clock operator, those are jobs of great renown. And at the Battle of Manila, he was killing bedbugs on the pillow. Oh, what a fighter was Rosenbaum." But you can see the background to that.
What was your father's name?
My father's name in English was Max, but in Hebrew it was Menachem Mendel.
Oh, man.
And he.
And your mother's name?
My mother's name was Basha Hena. She had no other name except her Hebrew name, mm-hmm. Betty Ann, if you want to call it that.
Was she employed outside the home, or was
no? She had 10 children.
I see. So she had a busy day.
So,
well, when you graduated from high school, what did you do then? Did you go directly to college?
Well, at that time, you had to have an 85 average to get into City College. I had the average, so I went to college. In order to get to college, I had to walk about a mile to the elevator, Lexington Avenue L. Do you remember the Lexington Avenue L?
And you went to City
Hall? They let me out at City Hall. Then I'd walk across the area there and get to a subway and take the Midnight Express. That's what we nicknamed for it was, because it was all blacks. That led me to 137th Street. So you can see it took me a long time to get to school.
Did you go to City College of New York?
Yes.
And did you spend all of your undergraduate college years there?
No. All of my undergraduate college, yes.
Yeah. And did you major in chemistry while you were at City College?
Well, I wasn't there long enough. I did it in about 3.5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I majored in physics mostly.
How did you happen to get an interest in science coming out of the
government
background?
I got a fellowship at NYU by the head of the department. And I was recommended by Professor Stevenson, who was a professor at City College in physical chemistry.
Mm-hmm. Well, when you then went on directly from college to graduate school at NYU?
By the time the graduate school was NYU. By the time I got through NYU, I had published 5 papers, and all of them were blockbusters. I made a lot of people rich.
Including yourself, I hope.
No, not myself. That's the trouble.
Sam, can I ask you, when you were in high school, what got you interested in chemistry and physics?
I was always interested in science. I would look up in the skies and say, Mika Mika Parwa Stella, Miro Quitam Sistam Bella, Spending Zemnus Inero, Alva Wellet Chemikilo. That's shine, shine, little star. I wonder what you are. Up above the world so bright, like a diamond in the sky. You remember that
yes.
Poem? And in those days, there were street lighters who came around and lit the posts, and the city was heated by gas. So if you looked up to the sky, the stars looked very close to you. And I felt an affinity for the stars.
Well, when you were at NYU in graduate school, what led you to pick organic chemistry as your specialization?
Well, the professor I had in organic chemistry was about the best man they had on their faculty, and I wanted to be like him. So I went into organic chemistry, and my first papers were I published how to make rose oil by condensing ethylene oxide with benzene. And I didn't realize that I had a blockbuster. Everybody jumped at that. They were trying to find out some way to make rose oil, which is a phenyl ethyl alcohol. And then I converted it to styrene resins. I dehydrated it, and that was another patent, and which I messed up. I met a patent attorney by the name of Oscar Link, who was a very nice guy, but that's about all. He was not clever. And he was very strict with me about what I wrote, and as a result, his patents were weak and were easily broken. So that I did not get the benefits of any of my patents. I have about 40 or 50 patents. I'll show you my publications in a few minutes.
Okay.
See when we're ready.
Well, when you graduated from NYU with your doctor's degree. Did you get a master's degree on the way, or did you...
I got a master's degree on the way. You know, just as a matter of fact. And they didn't give me a master's degree. They gave me an SCM, which stood for a Master of Science.
Yes.
And then I went on, and I was very stupid in my handling of these patents. You see, I had a rat for a professor. When I call, say, a rat, I mean a rat. He was a low-down character. And
was he the one that had
he
thought was the best one in the department?
Well, I didn't know who was the best one.
Yeah.
I just knew that he was looking for students, and I was a student. So he told me to go. He gave me a problem, and it was to condense ethylene oxide.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing that far. He told me to make rose oil,
mm-hmm.
which I did. I didn't realize that I had made a very important contribution. These were simple things to me.
When you graduated, you said you already had several publications.
I had about five publications.
Five publications. What was your first employment after getting your doctor's degree?
I went into teaching in high school. I had the misfortune of having a brother who was a history teacher in high school. They told me that the salary was very good and the jobs were very easy, and a lot of people who were, had their PhDs and so on went into the high school teaching. So I went into high school teaching and started teaching chemistry and general science.
It must have been unusual in those days for the high school chemistry teacher to have a doctor's degree.
I don't know if it was unusual. It was not so unusual. Because there were a lot of, I met a lot of people who, as a matter of fact, the objective of many high school, of many PhDs, was to pass the exam and get into the high school system because they paid so well compared to industry.
Oh, really? Quite a difference now, though.
You don't think there's a difference? I don't know about that. I think that the public school system generally pays a little better than, on an average, to the average person, than the college teaching. Teachers are very much underpaid.
Do you remember the name of the high school where you started teaching?
Girls Commercial High School.
Oh. Does that mean you had all girls in your class?
Yes, all girls.
I see.
They were very nice girls, too, very pretty. And they averaged about 15 years of age.
How long did you teach in that high school?
How long did I teach in that high school? I left the high school teaching. I don't remember. I'm trying to figure out when I left it.
Well, what did you go to from the high school? When you left the high school, what was your employment then?
I think I stayed in the high school until I was drafted by National Aeronautics and Space Administration to develop some instruments for them. And I developed some very interesting instruments. For example, I developed a machine which I've got packaged up downstairs. You'll see them this instrument picked up a capillary, washed the capillary through, and then sent the contents down a line. The object, my object was to analyze the blood of astronauts in the weightless atmosphere. And that was the easiest way to do it. So for 15 years, I ran, I had subsequently several jobs in as a clinical chemist. And I tried to define clinical chemistry as an elevated science, but the clinical chemist wouldn't allow himself to be raised to the level of a PhD.
Oh. Well, you started off with a very promising industrial career, I believe.
That's right.
What caused you to shift your interest from industrial chemistry to clinical chemistry?
Because I was not getting any money from the so-called industrial chemistry, and I was not earning a good salary. A teaching fellow got something like $65 a month, and a teacher in high school got about $5,000 a year. So I was perfectly satisfied with my income in high school, and I married a high school teacher. So I was involved in high school teaching, you might say.
And then you became interested in clinical chemistry, I believe.
I invented the term clinical chemistry.
Yes, but
the reason I invented it, because the high school I taught at originally, from Girls Commercial, had an annex. And the annex was a little building that was across the way from the Jewish Hospital in Brooklyn. And I went across the way to the Jewish Hospital in Brooklyn, and I found a very receptive person there. I found a man by the name of Benjamin Kramer. Benjamin Kramer had a master's degree from, I think, Indiana University. And he went on to Johns Hopkins and got his MD degree. And he was the first clinical chemist I'd ever met who was really a clinical chemist. Everyone else, now for example, Sobotka got a degree in Switzerland, I believe. And he got an appointment at in the Bronx at some hospital, and he was paid very well. And when I went to the Jewish Hospital in Brooklyn, the fellow who hired the personnel, I told you, had a master's degree in chemistry, and he hired a chemist from the Rockefeller Institute to do his analyses for him. The chemist from the Rockefeller Institute was Albert E. Sobel, S-O-B-E-L, who became my main famous, you might say, because I was pushing him all the time, and 95% of his contributions were contributions which I had made, and I encouraged him to publish them. And I left Albert E. Sobel to go to I've forgotten exactly where, but
was that when you moved to Rockford Memorial Hospital?
No, I went to Rockford Memorial Hospital by an accident. There was another, see, in my lifetime, I'm a very reasonable person, you might say. Too reasonable, in the sense that I tend to agree with people who don't know their left hand from their right. And every time I would get a consulting job with some industry, this guy Sobel would interpose himself because he had control of the laboratory. And he had no degree at all. But under my influence, he started going to night school at Brooklyn Polytechnic Institute, and I helped him with his master's thesis, and he finally got a master's degree.
He was in charge of the laboratory?
He was in charge of the laboratory. But the person who really was in charge was Benjamin Kramer. And he was really the first clinical chemist that I ever knew. And people knew him from the method of doing calcium determination called the Kramer-Tisdall method. Have you ever heard of that?
I haven't, but I'm sure you have.
But mention why you felt so highly regard for Benjamin Kramer as a clinical chemist. What was he unique? How was he unique?
Well, he was primarily a chemist, and he had gotten into medicine at the Johns Hopkins University. He was hired by Johns Hopkins University as a chemist, and he proceeded to develop this method for calcium. He studied and he's the author of the so-called calcium phosphorus product, the concept that if you multiply the calcium times the phosphorus, you see, see what it was doing. That was a well-known technique in chemistry the number had to be above a certain value in order for a calcification to take place. And he set up experiments in the laboratory. He would raise rats with rickets, and then he would kill them and take their bones and incubate them in little bottles in order to deposit the calcium and determine the level at which it deposits. And he discovered that if you multiply the calcium times the phosphorus level, you got a number, and if you exceeded that number, the bone would calcify. So you would say that he was the first clinical chemist I ever encountered.
Well, this year is the 50th anniversary, I believe, of the American Association of Clinical Chemists, and that's part of the reason for having this interview. And we would like for you to comment about your early involvement with the
Well, I can show you better. I prepared a series of reprints and had them Kinko reprint them so that they would be apparent. And that's the way my wife got killed. She got killed looking for a reprint. She climbed up on she drew out the lowest drawer and stood on that and tried to get something in the back, and she turned around to me and said, I wasn't in back of her, I was sitting on a couch, and she said to me, I'm losing my balance. That's the last words I heard from her. And she fell backwards and smashed her head against I'll show you what happened. And I feel very unhappy about that situation because I feel that I was responsible for her death, see, to a certain extent.
Well, you did what you could at the time.
I didn't do what I could. I could have made a stronger effort. I was sitting on a couch, but I couldn't get up. You see, like you'll see here, I have difficulty getting up unless I have a little support.
Yeah. Well, that's a very sad event, I know.
I feel depressed about that.
I'm sure you do, Dr. Nicholson. But
let's continue the interview upstairs. So, in honor of her memory, because that's what I want.
Do we have a place that we can sit down upstairs?
Okay. Yes.
Okay. You've gotten to Rockford and you're about to tell us about some of your work there?
Yes. I concentrated on microchemistry, and I developed a machine which I have in the basement. I have two copies of it, and I got a phone call from Othmer, O-T-H-M-E-R,
yeah,
who has a museum,
and he wanted me to write up an article on rose oil. So I said to him, "You write the article, and I'll publish it." Because I was sick and tired of this business. Nevertheless, after I did my study, I invented this word, you might say, the immature infant. And this is a copy. And I made about 2,000 copies of this and distributed it at an American Medical Association meeting. And if you look at the beginning of the book, I'll give you a copy of the... This is an enlarged copy of the book. Here.
Thank you.
As we open it up, you'll see it's made large because it was easier for them to copy it that way.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, you'll notice that there were 25 physicians who were involved. And the principle I established was this, that with chemistry, you could analyze a patient's blood or some other tissue and find out what his problem was and also what the solution is. And that's essentially what this immature infant. I said, if we read what I say in here, an immature infant is an infant who, you'll see first of all on the front page, there are 25 physicians engaged in this project, and I encouraged them, and each of them gave me at least one patient to work with. And the general attitude was, when you take the book home, you will see that what the current thought was at that time. Here's a copy for you.
I got one. You gave me. Thank you.
Okay. If you have a child, I was up against a tough competition. There was a fellow by the name of Smith, who was at Harvard, who had written a book on the premature infant, in which he said that if an infant weighs less than 1 pound, leave him alone for 24 hours. And what I show in this, one of the first experiments I did was to test his theory. I weighed a child, and I saw how much fluid he lost in 24 hours. And then I tried to bring him back with fluids, and I was unsuccessful. So I actually killed that child so as to prove my theory that the present situation which they used was unsatisfactory. And for the next 5 or 6 years, I concentrated on developing a machine that would analyze the blood of infants and which was good for space. I used space money, space travel money, to do it. And I've got the machines, two of them, down in the basement. I used them for 15 years in the routine laboratory. And then when I moved out, my successor was, I was pushed out by a pathologist. General rule was this. They would let you work until you were ready for retirement, and then they would say, they would hold an affair in your honor in which they would give you all kinds of awards like these plaques, and then they would tell you, get the hell out of here, which was a polite way of, this was a routine. I've got a number of plaques all over the place. If you turn around and look up there, you see the 29th annual meeting of clinical chemistry was I chaired that meeting, and some photographer put together all his pictures and put me in the center and made that picture. And this is my job. I came to Rockford. I made a terrible blunder. I made a blunder because I came where a son of mine, my oldest son, had now reached maturity. When he was about 12 or 14 years, went to Mexico with some friends of his and got back to Chicago at 2 o'clock in the morning. But the car just gave up its life. So he jumped the car to get money for food. Then he got on the telephone and he called the house. I was in Rockford, it's about 80 miles from Chicago. And he got his younger brother, who was only about 12 years old at that time. And he told him to go to Roy Coat and steal the keys and to get to the car and drive it out and drive it to Chicago. So my 12-year-old son did not realize that he was violating the law by driving through town after town after town without a license. But he managed to succeed in driving that car out of the my garage, getting into it, getting it started, and driving out. And you see, in Rockford, every house had a garage in the back. They had horses, and there was an alleyway. And he drove down the alleyway, drove out, and proceeded to deliver the car to Chicago. But my son, my number one boy, always wanted to outdo me. So he was messing with my car once, and I caught him at it, and I started to yell at him, and he started to run away, and I chased him. And after a short distance, I gave up, and he boasted for a week that he had outrun me. Actually, I was a very fast runner, and I was on the track team in high school, in elementary school. And I used to run the 100-yard dash in about 10 seconds, which was quite a feat for a boy who was 10 or 12 years old.
Yes.
Now, this is the reprint that she was looking to get, and I want to give you a copy and take it with you.
All right.
She tried to find, to help me find this reprint. Well, I got the reprint. I had copies made by Ginkgo. So that you could take them with you and read. And then I was interviewed by when I was about 65 years of age, I was interviewed by a fellow from the American Chemical Society. All the time, I was a chemist, first, the clinical chemist, second. And he found out that I had made rounds with Benjamin Kramer. And that's how I got into the role and became a clinical chemist. Now, finally, I was visited by Will Faulkner, and he stayed with me for a couple of days and figured out exactly what I was doing, and he wrote this article. So with these three articles, you got a copy of this? You ever able to write my history without me telling you?
But we want to have you tell us things that we would not find in these documents. We are very glad to have these documents to as resource material and as backup material, but we would like to specifically record your recollection.
24 hours a day,
and it's very easy to go there and have something copied in it.
Yes.
And a nice top put on and bound in such a way that the article becomes... Recently, I visited brother-in-law of mine who was dying from a peritoneal sarcoma. Peritoneal sarcoma is a growth of cells in the peritoneal cavity. And I was on the road to solving that problem when I was interrupted by my son, whom I call the rat-faced boy. My oldest son, when he was 4 or 5 or 6 years old, he took some nails, hammered them into a wooden windowsill, and put the hammer in the hands of his younger brother, and said, "Look what Ethan did." And of course, I knew immediately that he had done it. Ethan didn't have the power to hammer nails into a window. But he's, what would you call a person who has a, you would call it sibling rivalry,
yeah,
with his brother, but with his father. He's not a sibling of the father, his father.
No. Sam, you interested, you piqued my curiosity. When you were at Brooklyn Jewish Hospital,
yes,
you were there a reasonable amount of time. During that time, were you doing both jobs, high school teaching and as
That's
a
right. I would leave my high school job and go to the hospital and work at the hospital. And there I met this guy, J. Benjamin Kramer. And he took me by the hand and led me up to the floors and had me go from bed to bed to tell me what's wrong with this. An example, I took the blood of a woman who was suffering from hyperemesis gravidarum. You know, these women, they vomit like their guts out when they become pregnant. She had a very low potassium, so we tried to treat her with salt cubes, you know, that made from meat. But she didn't respond, and I analyzed the cubes and found there was no potassium in them. They had faked it. That was Bovril, B-O-V-R-I-L. So I took some meat, and I boiled the hell out of meat until I got it very concentrated. Then I lyophilized the residue, and then I did the potassium on that. And I had potassium. Then I gave that to the woman, and ever she had had 2 or 3 little cubes of this Bovril, which a homemade Bovril, you might say. She said, "I'm hungry, give me something to eat." And she started to eat and hold her food down. So that convinced me that the answer for many diseases is in this type of article by a chemist.
It must have been very gratifying to be able to identify that cause and to do something
well,
about it.
So I had a brother-in-law who gave me a Ruppert problem. He was dying of peritoneal sarcoma. In other words, he got so, and I remembered that I think it was Windaus who wrote an article saying that cancer cells tend to be acid. They're metabolizing very rapidly, and that if you could take advantage of that, you might be able to cure cancer, certain types of cancer. So I wrote an article which appeared in which I took younger son, my good son, had a setup down in Texas where he raised these mice which had no resistance to any disease, and you could inoculate them with any tumor. and he put the tumor under the skin and measured the amount that grew at the same time. Then I injected them with a chemical which would hybridize. In other words, I took the hydroxylamine. I chose hydroxylamine was a poison for cells. It was a mitogen, you might say. So I took hydroxylamine and made a whole serum. And then there was another thing I had discovered, that the roots of trees were loaded with an amino acid called homoserine, which was serine with one extra carbon, and the other was not present in any protein. So I made the homoserine hydroxylic acid and inoculated the mice in whom we had put a peritoneal sarcoma and cured the peritoneal sarcoma and killed all the mice. So I have a reprint. I should have had a reprint of that, but I don't seem to have one here. But anyway, someone else might pick this up. But that's the job of the clinical chemist. All right. You see, I wanted to make clear the job of the clinical chemist is to help the physician find the cause of disease and to cure the disease and find a cure for the disease.
How would you characterize your relationship with physicians, that is, personal interaction?
Well, I should have shown you some letters. My wife used to keep all the letters, and if I showed them the letters to the AMA, they'd put me in jail practicing medicine. And many of the letters said, my patient was near death and was not surviving, and you pulled her out. How you did it with your chemistry, I don't know, but you did it, you see. And I have a number of letters like that.
So you had the feeling that the physicians really respected you?
They were. I was very popular in the school, in the place there. And when I just told them that I was going to leave, when I got a couple of these letters, somebody included a $25 check that was something to hang me, I sent the check back to him and told him that that's not my, I'm not in the practice of medicine. But, of course, I really was. In other words, what I said, that practice of medicine should include clinical chemistry. And that's the message I'd like to leave with you. And you'll read that in the first article here. In this first article, Opportunities in Clinical Chemistry. Now what happened, now you'll see the people I had over there. You'll recognize Albert Cheney was the guy who set up an iodine message. Remember Cheney? Hugh MacDonald, he became president of the AMA. Samuel Nelson, Arnold Osterberg, and Joseph Routh. All of these people, they lambasted me for saying that a clinical chemist could be a person who did not have a PhD. So I changed it. I suddenly that was a changing point in my life, that I was inventing a new science, clinical chemistry, and that the definition of clinical chemistry should include the management of the patient. In other words, if you read in this book to see how you calculate out how much blood the patient needs, if you know the extracellular fluid volume and you know the weight of the patient, you can easily calculate out how much of a material you need to cure the patient. Well,
did you have
the title of this article, Opportunities in Clinical Chemistry, was great. And this was the article which you might say was the foundation stone of the clinic, at least what I consider the clinical chemist.
When did you have the feeling that the clinical chemist needed to be organized into an association?
I had that idea back when I was with Benjamin Kramer.
Did you have a major role in the organization of the American Association of Clinical Chemists?
I organized the thing. You see, these people all claim it. There were 9 people there, but the reason they were there was because I invited them.
I see.
And the person, I had to get someone in charge who they would respect, so I put, what's his name again?
Sobel?
What?
Sobel?
No, not Sobel.
Sobotka?
Sobotka, yeah.
Uh-huh.
He was, we held a meeting in his office, and he brought in his senior technician, who had written a little booklet on methodology, and that qualified her as a clinical chemist.
This referred you at the Jewish Hospital in Brooklyn?
I was at the Jewish Hospital in Brooklyn, yes.
When this took place. And you say there were 9 people you gathered together for that organizational meeting?
I would say that there were 9 people gathered together.
Do you remember any of them? Was Benjamin Kramer one of them?
What's that?
Was Benjamin Kramer one of the...
No, Benjamin Kramer had become completely involved in his medicine and became very rich because a physician became my son. My rat face son makes $1 million a year. He's a neurosurgeon. Mm-hmm. And in order to get into his office, you have to pay him $100. And he collects about $5,000 for one surgical procedure.
So, who were some of the invitees that came to Sobotka's office?
Well, you have them. You've published them many times.
Oh.
There were some that turned me down.
Who turned you down?
What's that?
Who turned you down?
I have to look back at my records.
Was Miriam Reimer one of the people who came? Miriam Reimer.
Reiner,
yes.
R-E-I-N-E-R.
Yeah.
She was Sobotka's senior technician.
Oh, okay.
So she was there.
Okay.
Do you have a feeling for how many potential members of the Association of Clinical Chemists there were at the time that you had this organization?
Well, the battle went on a larger scale. It was me against the society, practically, once it was organized, because the society fell in the hands of Mort Schwartz and characters like that. And the United States government was confused, so they held a symposium in Washington on what is a clinical chemist. I got them to agree to that because I was down in Washington all the time with the National Aeronautics and Space Administration. So
your position was that the clinical chemist was involved with patients, and
my position was self-made. That was, I made a clinical chemist who did what I, in other words, this one here which says, a clinical chemist who made rounds.
Yes.
And I felt that a clinical chemist should make rounds with a physician, go over each patient carefully, and see if in any way chemistry can help, and be qualified to help. For example, if you decide that the extracellular fluid of a patient is 20% of his blood volume, of his weight, and if he weighs 100 pounds, then you've got 20 pounds of fluid. And with 20 pounds of fluid, you have so much potassium or so much calcium or whatever it is to be added to the patient's body to bring them back to normal. So that it's not very difficult. You just have to know what it's about. But
You say that your position was in opposition to some of the
other... My position was in opposition to all of the whole organization.
What was the organization's position then?
The organization didn't have any position except that it was Get Nadelson, I was public enemy number one.
At what time in history, what year did that start evolving? Do you remember?
When
was this Get Nagelson policy or feeling starting to occur? It wasn't in your early days, was it?
Yes, it was right from the start, right from the beginning.
Oh.
It was.
You mean when, even when?
When we held a meeting, and I was invited to the meeting because they didn't know what I was stood for. Otherwise, they'd throw me out. This was a result of the first meeting.
Were you ever an officer in the American Association of
Criminal? No, I was head of the nominating committee for many years.
Well, did that enable you to make sure you...
I was doing the votes, but that's about all.
You were able to pick the people who ran the organization then?
Sometimes I could be, it was successful. I was a bad chooser. One was what's his name again? Always. His son committed suicide.
Mm.
What was his name?
That's not helping me help you.
There were three people with me in the room. One was the fat boy. Well, what was his name? Is willing to fail me.
That's all right.
I'm taking you.
What was the relationship of the AACC to other scientific organizations?
Well, every scientific organization looked at them with disrespect because they took such a meaningless position. If you read Sabatka's initial speech, most of that was material which I had told him. That his first speech as president of the society was that the chemist should involve himself more with the doctor and be involved in the treatment of the patient. And that is described in here.
Well, that was certainly your position, wasn't it?
It was my position, right from the start.
And so... When did you think that the AACC departed from that position?
I think that the biggest influence against my position was Mort Schwartz.
He was a clinical chemist. Was he president of the organization?
No, he was. He was. Every time I would appear at a meeting with the government holding a hearing, he was there, and he had a collection of about five or six people with him, who all voted against me. And I will use a standard argument that a nurse with 8 years' experience doesn't make her a doctor. You see, I said a clinical chemist is a science like any other science. And I can show you in here.
Did you find a different attitude among the various members of AACC, depending on their affiliation, that is, were the academics different from
I found that I was
private practice or different from
I was universally you see, sodium chloride and desoxycorticosterone needs in adrenal insufficiency in the infant determined by a correlation of chemical and clinical data. Now, I bring out very clearly that this adrenal immaturity may not involve the adrenal at all, and it turned out later that it did not. It involved the kidneys. You see, I've always wrote it with quotation marks. Adrenal maturity is a common finding in a premature infant. Immature infants.
Well, the small infant is at a disadvantage in that the rate of water evaporation and heat loss is greater in proportion to body weight. The stomach capacity of the infant, even if it... I also introduced the plastic tubing, you know, you put down through the nose. I'd use it on dogs, and then I use it in infants.
Well, what do you perceive to be the significant contributions of the AACC to the field of clinical chemistry?
I feel that the contributions I suggested at the beginning in this little booklet are still the same. Get the data, measure the data, and see if you can find some chemical way of treating the disease.
Do you think that the American Association of Clinical Chemists has been particularly helpful to clinical chemists?
It hasn't been helpful. It's been helpful in a financial way. Clinical chemists today are paid a little better than they used to be paid. But at the time that I got involved in it, they were not a housewife who could handle a frying pan became the clinical chemist. Do you remember when you were in the middle of that war that was going on? He was in the middle of the war. What happened was that a number of people on research grants were appointed at the universities. And when money became tight and they eliminated these grants, then these people became supernumerary, and they became unemployed. I sized them out, and somehow or other I found out who, and Myron was one of them, and hired him. And if you hired one of those, the government would pay him the same salary that he got as a professor at the university if you taught him a new science. And that white book over there has one of his contributions in it. And I started that method of publishing monographs for the university. That Fundamentals of Clinical Chemistry was my assistant, whom I imported from Germany. His name was Haux, H-A-U-X, I believe.
Sam, when the American Association for Clinical Chemistry first started, way back in 1948, when you helped start it, what was the criteria for membership? Was there a limitation at all?
There was no limitation. Anybody who said he wanted to join could join.
Okay. So there was no requirement that you had to be a PhD?
No.
How did it differ such that
there was no program in clinical chemistry for trained clinical chemists?
Yeah, until later on.
That came later.
Yeah. When in the middle 70s, when the Chicago group decided to form the Academy, the National Academy,
yes,
of Clinical Biochemistry, what were the changes, or why did they form that compared to?
They formed that because the under the influence of Mort Schwartz and his gang, that's what I refer to them as, they abolished, at least we got one concession from the clinical chemists, and that was the entitlement as fellow. If you had taken your boards and passed your boards and you had a PhD, you became a fellow. Well, Mort Schwartz succeeded in getting that abolished, and not only did he get it abolished, but he went down to Washington to debate with me against the clinical chemist having a PhD.
because the government was fair about this thing. They wanted to find out what the Six Picture was about. And it was not only Walt Schwartz, but he had a whole gang of them. Some of them then became president of the society. And I was pushed aside as a fly in the ointment, you might say.
You get a picture of the history of clinical chemistry from these three reprints and the copy of that, The Immature Infant. I first became a national figure with this booklet, you see, and it was not only me, but there were two other doctors, particularly Dr. Crawford and Dr. Muncy. I convinced them that they, by working with their infants, that the clinical chemistry had something to offer. And I wrote this booklet completely from beginning to end, and they endorsed it. And all the physicians on the staff at Rockford Memorial Hospital got to know me, and they were very enthusiastic in supporting me.
Do you feel that through its 50-year history, AACC has been responsive to member needs?
I don't know if they're responsive to member needs, but I don't believe that's the way you should put it.
Okay, how should we put it?
Should we put it this way? What is a clinical chemist? Should a clinical chemist be involved in the management and treatment of the patient? Should he develop new and better ways of treating disease and use his chemical knowledge? Should he manage operations in various hospitals with that in mind? That's essentially what I feel a clinical chemist is.
Do you feel that the association helps provide that kind of focus or interaction?
The association has taken a laissez-faire attitude. They have not supported, but they did abolish the fellow and the way it was abolished was a meeting was held. And one of Mort Schwartz's colleagues kind of made a motion that they should abolish the concept of fellow. And it was seconded, and it was turned down.
Did they have any fellows
Wait a minute.
At that time?
There were many fellows.
Did they lose their title of fellow at that time?
That's when they lost the title of fellow. So they waited until the majority of people in there who supported me, I was on one side and they were on the other side, that the fellow was an essential part of the objective of the society. And they waited until they got a majority, then they voted again. They kept voting. It was an illegal system that they used, and that then was the way they operated.
Did you have any idea of why
Pardon me?
What, did you have any idea of why the title of fellow was opposed by them?
Yes. They felt that I was requiring too much of the clinical chemist, that the clinical chemist was not in any way prepared to help the physician in treating the patient, and therefore they should not have the title of fellow. And I felt that he had the background, and that with very little training, he could go on. For example, in this booklet, I point out the fact that I'm using the term immature infant because I can't think of any other term. An immature adrenal gland, I said, adrenal immaturity, but that there's no evidence that the adrenal is involved at all. As a matter of fact, it's not involved. What is wrong with the premature is his kidneys are not properly developed to handle the retention of sodium.
You've spoken a bit about some of the negative aspects of AACC during your career and your conflicting opinions with some of the persons in it. Can you identify any particular positive changes in AACC during your career?
As far as I'm concerned, I have not seen any positive changes. I believe that they've taken the position of supporting that's the pathologist's job. The position they take is that the pathologist should run the chemistry lab, and because it's a source of income, a huge source of income, and that's the only thing that counts.
Well, does that mean that the persons that were taking that position were pathologists?
Pathologists, many pathologists did not feel that was the case. They welcomed the chemist. I can't say that every pathologist, but there were some pathologists who took advantage of something dropped in their lap, and they became the clinical chemists, if you want to call it that.
Well, go ahead.
Okay. Many of the private outfits opposed it. As a matter of fact, I have an award here from one of the commercial laboratories who gave me an award trying to shut me up because I was fighting them, and they didn't help.
Didn't work.
But I took their award. And I hung all the awards up on the walls. You see them all around the room. This is my awards room.
Sam, I get the impression that some clinical chemists practice clinical chemistry similarly to the way you describe they ought to, depending on what their situation.
I don't know of any. Well, at least I would put it that way.
Okay.
They may. You probably will practice it to a certain extent.
Yeah, but actually very limited in when you have a private practice. But in the university setting, some do.
I think that it's worse in the university setting than anything else. I've never seen a university yet. When I was at I tried to practice clinical chemistry at the veterinary school. And I established normals. I established a course, and the veterinarian was very anxious to learn about this. And what happened was I started with about five people, and I ended up with about 30 people. They started coming in and listening to the lectures because they all had animals to deal with. So the normal level. How could you tell what the normal level of a chloride was if you never did a chloride determination before? How would you interpret it, especially with animals? And there's a wide variation among animals as to what they normally run. So I have not lived long enough to see the clinical chemist get his due, what he should. In other words, if the clinical chemist took my pathway, they would all be rich. They would be very wealthy, because they would be practicing medicine to a certain extent, like my son. And a clinical chemist would be respected.
You mentioned your son as a physician. Do you think he respects clinical chemists in the way that you would like for him to?
He hates my guts.
Oh, really?
Because he tries in every possible way to interfere with my working. He feels that I'm invading his pasture.
What about Ethan?
He's different. He works with me. He's reasonable.
Well, you wrote a book with him.
That's right. And when he started to study the literature, he realized that I was right. Well, I wrote a number of books. I started writing a series of books on clinical chemistry. What is that?
That's your book with your son, Ethan.
Yeah. The principles of applied clinical chemistry.
How do you feel that...
In my books, I don't criticize anybody. I just say what I think ought to be done.
Well, even though you've had differences of conviction from some members of AACC, did you maintain your membership in the association through all your career?
I refused to give up, I say. As a result, I paid my dues and like everybody else.
Did you find that attending the meetings was helpful in your career in terms
of... Yes, I think so.
Okay. Interacting with other clinics?
I was a spy. I found out what the other side was doing.
The contact with other members of the association, I presume, was important to you.
Yes. You see, I was more than a clinical chemist. I was actually, well, one might say, an engineer to a certain extent. If you look at that cabinet over there against the wall, that's made of pure mahogany all the way through. I made four such. Here's another one. And they're very heavy. And if you read the Owl and the Pussycat, the poem, you'll see that that person knew the history of the... You see, if you left... The Owl and the Pussycat involves the marriage between the Queen of Sheba and a pharaoh. As a matter of fact, the bishop wears the double crown of Upper and Lower Egypt.
Did you build them yourself, the cabinets?
Yes, I built these cabinets myself. I enjoyed doing that kind of work.
Sam, one of the things that you, from what I can tell, made a major contribution to, clinical chemistry was your desire and interest and explorations in miniaturizing things to use low volume or micro techniques. In fact, you wrote
that. That came from my job, my first major job at
Rockford.
At Rockford Royal Hospital.
And how? Give us some background of how this evolved, so that you spent so much interest in clinical chemistry.
Eventually, I tried to make a machine which would do this automatically, and I had capillaries built And that came about from my relationship with the NASA. How do you draw blood space at weight or in a weightless atmosphere without an atmosphere, with an uncertain atmosphere? And I decided to use capillarity, just stick the finger and put the capillary and let it run up to the end. And I built two machines. Well, I employed two engineers, the Kraft brothers, who were in the business of machining stuff. And at my direction, they made these two machines. And one I set up in my laboratory to do phosphorus. You remember that? Running there. And the other I set up to do infrared analysis for some, because I was looking at blood, you know, and I was looking at the hemoglobin and other related materials. I have them down in my basement.
Sam, of all the patents you had, the 50-some-odd patents, what do you believe is your most important one?
It's not what I believe is the most important. It's what has been most successful. Okay. The one that makes rose oil from phenyl ethyl alcohol. It turns out to be the simplest invention and made several companies very rich.
How about you?
No. I'm not a good businessman.
Well, among your clinical chemistry inventions, which one do you think has been most successful?
The idea that the very idea of using small volumes of material, you know the machines that pick up with a very fine capillary,
yes,
suck up small amount, 10 microliters, 5 microliters. The general idea of using small amounts of material.
Well, do you feel at ease or content with the development of the field of clinical chemistry today?
No.
What major change would you like to see in the field itself?
I would like to see the clinical chemist, first of all, get paid a decent salary. A few of them are. He's paid a decent salary. But I'd like him to have the position of the pathologist. In other words, equivalent to the pathologist and at the head of any department. See, when I was at Michael Reese, I was head of the Department of Biochemistry, but actually I was a member of a group of heads of departments of the whole institution, and I had a tremendous amount of influence on the policies of the hospital. In other words, I would like to see the clinical chemistry be taught in the medical schools as a requirement.
Do you see any indication that the field is moving in that direction?
No, I don't see any indication. I see the pathologists getting richer and richer, but that's about all. But they're called pathologists.
What do you think is going to be the future of clinical chemistry?
I believe eventually the clinical chemist will be recognized as an important individual in the hospital and in the management and treatment of patients. I think that time is coming.
What do you think is leading to that change from the way you perceive things now?
I think a lot of things is that certain institutions are centers of learning for all over the country, and people are going to places like the Rockefeller Institute to be treated for particular diseases, and I believe that that is the motivation. The motivation for any change will be an economic one.
Persons that have previously written accounts about you, including two of these photocopies that you gave us here, emphasize your seeming boundless energy. Do you see yourself that way?
I don't know. I was basically originally an athlete, you might say. I ran for my elementary school in a 100-yard dash. I ran for my high school. I played football. My sport was baseball. I still have a broken finger from the Texas League trying to make me into a catcher. In those days, you couldn't grab the ball with your glove. Your catch mitt was like a pillow, so you had to go like this, catch it and put your hand over. And I was just a little slow and broke my finger.
It looks as though it's crooked just right for putting over the end of a pipette.
Well, it's put just right. I was also a pitcher. It helped me as a pitcher. I could throw a curve that broke about 3 feet and go one right into the...
Well, Sam, I was reading about your technique for batting, that you, instead of following the pitch as it came towards you, you set up a focal plane.
That's right.
Tell us about
that. I used to watch until the pitch came into my view. I didn't look at the... They used to tell the batters, look at the... pitcher. I say, don't look at the pitcher. Look at the plate, and in the view you have your plate and an area here, and when the ball comes into that area, then you swing. And it didn't make any difference where I was. I was always the best hitter.
So it worked for you.
The last time I batted 385. For before the Texas League became a big league, when it was a minor league.
Did you ever have an ambition to join the big league?
While I was catching for this team, I got a notice that I had been appointed at NYU to become a teaching fellow. So I quit my job and I went for a tremendous reduction in salary. But about $35 a month to become a teaching fellow.
But it was more interesting to you, or is that it?
Well, I was not an athlete, mate. I was essentially an athlete only because there was nobody else around who could bat 385, you see. But I like to play ball as a sport. I like to fungo, you know, and hit the ball very far. But I consider my major goal in life to upgrade the role of the clinical chemist as a failure.
Well,
I've lost to the pathologist and to private industry.
Well, when you started out your career in clinical chemistry, there was really hardly a field of clinical chemistry. So you had hardly any role models to attract you to the field.
No, I had no role models.
What was it then that persuaded you to
give up a very promising start in industrial-oriented chemistry and go into clinical chemistry, that you didn't have anyone to look to?
Well, because you follow your nose, you see. That's the way the cookie crumbled. It happened to be in a hospital. I happened to have a job in a hospital. I didn't say, I'm going to quit now and go and do this. I just did what I was...
What needed to be done.
What I thought needs to be done.
What prompted you to first take that job in the hospital?
Nothing. I was teaching school at Girls Commercial High School, and there was an annex next to the school, and an annex to some other school. And I, when I went into the laboratory person welcomed me. That was Albert E. Sobel. And I think you'll find his picture in one of these.
Mm-hmm.
Sobel, of course, didn't have the philosophy that I had. He went along with Sobotka. Although Sobotka eventually was won over to my position. If you read his inaugural speech at the clinical chemistry, when he was first elected president, in his speech he said a clinical chemist should be consulted in the management of the patient.
Sam, going back to when you had this meeting that initiated the thoughts about forming the AACC back in, I assume, 1947 or...
Whatever year it is.
One of the people, apparently in one of your articles here, you listed them, and there really were nine. There was a Max Friedman.
Max Friedman was a creation of Harry Sobotka. Max Friedman was working for a small hospital and also had a private small lab, and Harry Sobotka enlisted him to join the group, and he eventually became president of the society. But he was basically, he wasn't too bright.
Tell us about Julius Carr.
Julius Carr was a nice guy. And he also was a product of Albert E. Sobel. But he never did make a decent living.
Now, did Sobel move from Brooklyn Jewish to another hospital in New York?
He was paid very well at the Brooklyn Jewish. When Kramer left or retired, Sobel took over the job. That happened in many places. For example, it happened at Cook County Hospital that when the fellow in charge of the chemistry lab retired, the fat boy, what was his name? Do you remember his name?
Dubin?
Dubin, yes, took over. Dubin was a technician. He had no degree.
Tell us about Mary McKenna.
Mary McKenna was a friend of mine from my days at NYU. She was I don't know too much about her, but she was involved in clinical chemistry as a job she got from many chemists who were trained in colleges. Eventually got jobs as clinical chemist at hospitals.
Mm-hmm. So Mary had a doctorate degree?
Mary
McKenna had a doctorate degree,
yes.
From NYU? Let's see, you mentioned... two other people in that group. Joseph Kahn.
Joseph Kahn died about that time.
Oh.
And he was also a friend of Sobel's and a friend of
Sobotka?
Sobotka, yes.
And how about Lou
Well, he was dead.
Lewis Doty. You remember that name?
Doty, yes. Doty was in charge of the library at Presbyterian he was in charge of the laboratories at Presbyterian Hospital in New York City.
So, Sam, I know you know your feelings of why clinical chemists should start a society. What do you think some of these people were interested in?
They were motivated by their invitation from Harry Sobotka. He loaded this meeting with his friends. He just called them and said, will you come attend the meeting?
Mm-hmm. But these were pretty much some of the major clinical chemists in New York City at the time?
I wouldn't say they were the major clinical chemists.
So who was left out?
I don't know who was left out, okay, because I didn't know all the clinical chemists.
Okay.
But Mary McKenna was a friend of Harry Sobotka and Sobel, both of them, probably contacted her.
When you look back, of all the people you associated with in the years you were in clinical chemistry and in the AACC, who are the individuals that you still have a warm feeling for and liked? You had a warm feeling for Doty. Go ahead.
Yes. I had a warm feeling for Mary McKenna. There were several people on it. There were several people among the nine you didn't mention who, after that meeting, quit and refused to be part of it because Sobotka was dominating the meeting.
In later years, who do you think of very highly of? Later, you know, in like the 1980s and 70s.
There are several, but I've forgotten their names. You see, you have to remember that I have an approaching Alzheimer's disease. And
I wouldn't think so.
Well, you may not think so, but I know so. And I've been taking such things as ginkgo, you know, the extract of the ginkgo tree, and I've been drinking a lot of warm hot tea because the papers appear from time to time comparing, say, those who drink hot tea and those who drink coffee, and they say if you drink hot tea, especially black tea, that you have a lesser severe case of Alzheimer's disease.
Do you think it worked with you?
I don't know. I haven't got much of a memory.
Well, tell me, what do you remember Mort Epstein?
He was the one I was trying to think of. Mort Epstein's son committed suicide. One of the characteristics of young folks is to get a noose and hang it up and twist it until they almost choke. And sometimes they overdo it and died. And Moriarty's son committed suicide that way. You know, it's a sort of a sexual excitement that they get. But Mort Epstein always sided with, whenever I was at a meeting, everybody was against me because I was a purist. I said that the clinical chemist should be a clinical chemist. And as a result, see, I liked Mort Epstein because he treated me to some very tasteful spaghetti.
Well, during your career, you were at several different hospitals as chair of the Department of Biochemistry after you left Jewish Hospital. Which one of those positions did you think you had the best opportunities for your career development?
I didn't have a good opportunity in any of them. For example, I was at the St. Vincent's Hospital, and I moved my X-ray spectrometer there, and they made me sign a paper saying that if anybody got hurt, that I would be responsible personally for the X-ray spectrometer. That's the kind of influence I had, and that's the and the more they opposed me, the more the stronger wave came. Well, I'm a very stubborn guy.
What was it that persuaded you to move to St. Vincent's from Rockford Memorial Hospital then? If they didn't,
I started getting letters thanking me for helping them save their patients, and I knew that that meant jail, straight in jail for me. There would be one doctor who would put an official complaint to the AMA. The AMA had made a deal with a chemist, a clinical chemist, in 1929, that they would not interfere with the development of clinical chemistry. But they did. And if the AMA would like to get some of these letters that my wife had, do you have any of those letters around?
I look for them, Dr. Nelson.
What?
I look. Now, I don't know where they're at.
Sam, so you, that means at Rockford you did have very good opportunities, as
yes,
told by this book, to
at Rockford I could convince the doctors that I was useful to them by working them with patients. For example, one of the patients, I went to New York City to look for a job, and I was treating a patient who had a ruptured appendix. And I told the people there that at the Brooklyn Jewish, I had seen that something like 70 patients who had a ruptured appendix, and they all referred the pain to some other part of the body. And there were several physicians who said that this patient had a ruptured diverticulum. You know, a diverticulum is a part of the opposite side of the bed. So I said to them, if anybody here wants to take my bet, I'll bet them $1 to $0.01 that this patient does not have a ruptured diverticulum. So they said, how do you know that? They said, I said, because I used to make rounds at the Brooklyn Jewish Hospital, and I saw about 90 patients with the ruptured appendices, and they all had pain. See, that was in this work. And they all had referred the pain to the other side of their body. Well, you'll read it when you get home.
Sam, when you... What? If I understand your explanation, you left Rockford because you were afraid that the AMA would
get after
you because you participated in patient care so
That's
intimately.
Right.
But you only spent a year at St. Vincent's before going to Roosevelt, I guess it was.
Yes.
Well, because at St. Vincent's, The nuns were terrible. They kept bothering me, you know, with my X-ray spectrometer. They felt that there was a public menace.
Did you take your X-ray spectrometer to Roosevelt with you?
Yes. And they felt that I should be personally responsible for it. And
was the attitude at Roosevelt?
There was a sister
better
assigned above me to watch that image, just to watch that machine. And it was Sister Henrietta. And she would hang around and watch the, see to it that nobody went near the X-ray spectrometer. And I never did. Later on, it turned out that X-ray spectrometry was used by NASA in analyzing moon rocks and things like that.
Did you find the reception and the opportunities at Roosevelt Hospital better than you had found at St. Vincent?
No, I never found any acceptable place as acceptable as Rockford Memorial. The reason being that this fellow here, this one person, Woodruff L. Crawford, he brought me into Rockford, and he sort of felt responsible for me, so he would pay close attention to what I was doing, and he was very helpful. The Muncie was his assistant, and so these three doctors were helpful and saw how I operated, and they saw the logic of what it was.
What was life like as a clinical chemist at Roosevelt?
At Roosevelt? That's a good question. I didn't get a chance to practice as a clinical chemist at Roosevelt.
But you must have made a pretty good name for yourself, because didn't Michael Reese invite you to come back to Illinois?
My reputation was made in Rockford.
Okay. So what got you to go back to Illinois?
Because I wanted to get away from these letters that started to pile in. My wife has a bunch of them. If I had them here, you'd see that I had committed suicide 6 times over. I used to smoke long cigars, and then I stopped.
I didn't know you when you smoked cigars.
I started smoking in Rockford before I met you. And I got pneumonia, and I stopped smoking for about a month. And I never went back to it.
Well, I suppose you officially retired in 1979 when you were 70 years old.
That's right.
And you moved here to Knoxville. What prompted you to choose Knoxville as the place for your retirement?
Because my son was inviting me to come here.
This was your good son, right?
No, this is my bad son.
So you went to the home of your bad son?
I didn't know that what he was trying to do was trying to destroy me. And he's succeeded pretty well. You see, he kept writing letters to the state saying that I shouldn't drive a car, I'm too old. But he didn't write the letters. He always got some friend of his to write letters. They never examined me. They just signed anything he wrote. I recognized his handwriting many times. But what I intend to do is to sell this house and get out of Knoxville, to get away from him.
Where do you want to go?
I will go to my brother's house.
Where is that?
That's New Jersey. They have a reciprocal agreement with Knoxville. But he has a son who lives in Montana. I may end up in Montana.
Have you ever been to Montana?
Pardon me?
Have you ever been to Montana?
No. I'll go anywhere where I can get away from this evil monster that's around my neck.
What about Tulane? What about Texas?
Texas also has a reciprocal agreement with Tennessee.
Reciprocal for what? A driver's license?
Yes. In other words, he has marked me lousy. He's marked me as a criminal. And I don't like that.
Where is your son Ethan living?
Ethan lives in Texas. Had I known what I know now, I would never have moved into Knoxville. I would have moved to Texas.
Well, while you've been in Knoxville, you've had an appointment as adjunct professor at the College of Veterinary Medicine. Have you found that to be reasonably satisfying?
That's just on paper.
You haven't had anything to do there?
No.
Well, I came to visit you one time. And
I lectured to the students there on the use of clinical chemistry in animals. And I gave courses. But
you had office space and lab space.
I had office space and lab space.
Well, that must have been satisfying for your retirement period.
That was very satisfying. But my son got after me and got them to take it away. He said to me, "I've got to get you under control." That's the way he put it.
Sounds like what you used to say to me.
What?
Sounds like what you used to say to me.
That I have to get you under control. Well, I don't think I ever tried to get you under control.
All right.
Well, do you think of anything else that you need to tell us to make the story about your career and your association with AACC complete?
If I don't get out of the clutches of my older son, I'll commit suicide.
Well, we hope it won't come to that.
I hope so, too. Because I can't stand the son of a bitch. When I look at him, I get angry just looking at him.
He seems, though, that he has your welfare in mind.
That's a lot of crap. Oh. He doesn't have my welfare in mind. He wants to control me. He's a vindictive louse.
Well, surely he didn't inherit that trait from you.
Well, I don't know. He's stubborn and I'm stubborn.
Dr. Washoe, do you think of more that you
well,
want to ask?
Sam, let's talk a little about Ethel.
Ethel
she played a role in your career through the years.
Ethel was, her god was this son. That's why I'm here. I never would have come here except for my wife. That was her older son, her darling. And she didn't see him as I see him. Because he was not opposing her. If she wanted a lift to downtown or a place like that, he immediately rushed and gave it to her. If I wanted a lift, the answer was no.
But going back in time a little bit, in the early days of your career, can you remember how Ethel participated?
She never participated much in my career. She just sort of... Well, I'll give you an example. Let's assume that these are three rooms connected. She was studying in this room. The kids were in this room. They wanted to get over here to get to sleep. She wouldn't let them through until she was finished studying. She went to Brooklyn College and was a bookworm. And,
Sam, I have some good memories of you and Ethel. What did you do at Michael Reese every Christmas time? Do you remember
that time? Yes. I used to give out gifts to the technicians.
And they put on a potluck thing and all the ethnic dishes, right?
That's right.
And didn't Ethel help you choose the gifts?
No, she didn't help me at all. When I met a speech in Montreal and came home exhausted, the first thing she asked me was whether I got a good reception. She was not interested in me at all. She just wanted to use me as a totem pole, you might say. She was part of. I'm a very unhappy man, you see. And I've always been a very unhappy man.
But you've had a very successful career.
I know, first of all, it's been successful for other people, but not for me. I have not achieved what my goals were.
What were your goals?
My goals were to make the clinical chemist a self-respecting individual.
You don't think they are self-respecting?
No. I made him, he's still a tool of the pathologist.
You certainly have developed a number of techniques, procedures that have meant better medicine for lots of patients.
That's true. But I didn't develop it for the patients. I developed it for a patient. In other words, when I had a particular patient, and when you read this book, you got a copy of this,
yes.
I hope, you'll see that I call it the condition of the premature, an immature infant. But actually, I'm merely saying that, for want of a better word, I call it adrenal immaturity. Because that's what would happen if he did have adrenal immaturity. And these are different points of my, high points in my career, you might say, these three papers.
Mm-hmm.
This is my initial conception of the idea of a clinical chemistry society. This is, was accidentally this. Member of the American Chemical Society came to visit me, and he wrote this article. And this is the final article by Walker, who wrote the article reviewing my career, and this is fairly complete. You see, what they all are influenced by is the fact that when they came here, they saw me working outside, pouring cement or concrete or something like that, you see. Because I like to do that. I like to build something. Like these bookcases. They're too big. If I had to do over again, I'd make them smaller.
Well, they're filled up with books. You'd have to have more of them if you had them
right.
Smaller.
I've got two more of them down in the basement. I didn't show you those. Maybe I should finish the tour of this section here. Would you like to come with me? And
I will interrupt the recording at this time and perhaps get back to it after you give us a tour of your house.
Sure.
You referred during the conversation so far to your two sons, Stephen and Ethan.
Yes.
Did you have any other children?
Yes, I had two girls. One was Lisa and the other was Nina.
Are they professionals also?
Well,
like your
I
son?
Think so. Lisa is a, works for the CIA.
What did she do there? Was she a spy?
No, it's the highest job that you can have in our category. She went to the University of Pittsburgh, and she got a PhD in linguistics. So she's been figuring out new and better ways of training spies. In other words, she gets behind a curtain of some sort and has the spy interviewed by someone who's looking to see if it's a spy. And if he's unsuccessful, then she applies that she feels she's been successful. If he is successful and calling out which of the five or six people that they have is a spy and which is actually... In other words, she teaches them to speak the native language of a particular community.
That's right. That's right.
Rather than the book learning. And she invented that system.
And which daughter is that?
Lisa.
That's Lisa.
Her name is Alyssa Rebecca.
And what does your other daughter do?
She,
and with Israel.
Is taken up with animal rights. So she makes recordings of teaching sessions for Arab and Jewish children in Israel. And she called the organization Chai, C-H-A-I, which means life in Hebrew. But it's officially the Committee to Help the Animals in Israel. And she organized the thing and has raised money for it, and I've given her money for it.
Does she live in Israel?
No. She visits Israel and goes from school to school, both Arabic and Israeli, and makes speeches.
Where does Lisa live?
Lisa lives in Washington, D.C.
And your other daughter's name is what?
Nina Beth.
Nina.
Where does Nina live?
Nina lives in Washington also. She's the daughter named after my mother. Her mother's name was Basha Hanna. Bessie Anna or Betty Ann. And she has her name reversed. Ann Betty. Oh, no, well, Nina Beth, we called her when she was young. And that's my younger daughter. They're both professionals.
And you have about seven grandchildren, you said?
Yes. And most of them are female.
You think any of them will become a clinical chemist?
No. They've all chosen their careers by now. The girls have their careers as, you might say, instructors or teachers. The boy is still in a formative stage. I don't know what his career is going to be. Mm-hmm. But he drives a car, and I've spent most of my available cash to help him go to Israel, and it has paid off. I went to a synagogue during the high holidays, and they got new books and the print got smaller and the pages got shinier. It was very difficult for a person with my lack of vision to see. Mm-hmm. And he read it to me as fluently as you can. And that was worth all the money that I spent for him.
He read it to you in Hebrew?
Well, he can read Hebrew. So he read the Hebrew, mm-hmm. and of course I translated it into English. Mm-hmm. But my bad son has married, started out by living illegally with a woman, and she was pregnant, and I paid him the money to go to Cuba so she could get an abortion. He then came back, and he came back to Knoxville, and he took up with another nurse, and she was pregnant, and he was going to marry her. So he asked me to investigate her. So I investigated her, and I found out that she was a little crazy. So I told him what I just found out. He married her, and he had two more children. The children are adorable, but he has remained unchanged. His object in life is to destroy me. I went downstairs and I discovered something else he had done. You see, I was making capillaries out of, I had an oxygen torch and a connection for an oxygen, for an oxygen tank. So I turned back the oxygen tank and I was making capillaries by using the gas and a micro burner. So he found that out. So I noticed that down below he had the gas turned off. He sits up nights figuring out ways of torturing me.
Maybe he's afraid you were going to burn yourself.
That's baloney. That's what he would like to see.
Sam, what the...
These are the arguments he uses, and he's doing these things for my benefit.
Sam, is Nina married?
Nina, yes. She's married to a fellow by the name of Cohen.
Do they have children?
No, they have no children. And she didn't have any children. And it turned out that she had a brain tumor. So she went and had an operation done and then had the brain tumor removed. By that time, she got divorced from a rat husband. She was good riddance of him, but she hasn't been married. I don't think she'll ever have any children.
He writes poetry.
Sam, how old are your children?
Pardon me, how old they are?
Yes.
Well, I'll start from the top. The doctor who is torturing me is now about 30s. His late 30s.
Stephen?
Yes. Then the number two boy, Ethan. He's about 35. Stephen's about 41 or so. And then Lisa is about 40. And Nina is about 35.
Well, can you think of anything else you would like to tell us about your family or your career?
No, I would only like to say that
I'm glad your gentleman came here. I was able to give my message to the clinical chemists as a whole.
Well, we have it recorded in your own word.
That's right. In other words, I feel that a clinical chemist should concern himself with not only the management of laboratories, but with the management of the patient, and act as a consultant to the medical staff, as a specialist. In other words, the physician will hire a specialist to do surgery for him, in which he is not skilled, and by a surgeon who is approved by him and has his medical boards. Well, when a surgeon or a physician has a patient whom he is treating, he should consult a clinical chemist, and the clinical chemist should have the capability of using his science to investigate what's wrong with the patient and how would be the best way to go and treat him.
Do you think that physicians in general are inclined to consult the clinical chemist in that way?
No. They're not inclined to consult him now. But if they had the experience of the clinical chemist at Rockford Memorial Hospital, they would. See, I have worked with physicians who started out by giving their patients potassium penicillinate because they're afraid of sodium. They read somewhere in a book that sodium is a bad thing for patients. And they even give them potassium penicillinate to a patient who has low potassium. And now, of course, they would never do a thing like this. They would consult with a clinical chemist if they could find one. Or they would try to act as a clinical chemist would act in some way to use chemistry to treat their patients.
Well, I want to thank you for participating in this interview for the Chemical Heritage Foundation and for the American Association of Clinical Chemists. I'm sure that the archival record of your recollections of your career and the message that you've gotten out will be a valuable resource for persons in time to come.
I hope if it saves one life, and it's worthwhile. For example, there was a patient who was very sick, and that patient that they had a meeting on decided that he had a ruptured diverticulum, and a ruptured appendix is a dangerous thing. But today we have penicillin products which can load the patient up and keep him alive. So I've seen patients loaded up with penicillin, and then the rupture appendix is sutured closed and washed in the antiseptic fluids, and the patient then recovers. But I've never seen any of them recover if they're surgically treated for a ruptured diverticulum, which they don't have. So I recognize the fact that the clinical chemist has a definite place in the community, in the medical community, and that he should use his skills for helping the physician manage and treat the patient rather than to make money, because it's the clinical chemist opens up a private laboratory. He will make large sums of money as the analyses come in. But if he tries to set up a practice to advise the physician on how to treat the data, that he would be doing something much more useful. And that's what the message I would like to teach.
Well, I hope that this recording will help spread your message more effectively than perhaps it might have been spread before.
I hope so too.
Thank you very much for giving us the time today and
Thank you for coming here.
We're almost on top of your birthday. I hope that you have a very happy birthday celebration on Saturday.
Thank you very much.
This is the end of the recorded interview. The voice you now hear is that of James G. Trainum, interviewer. The occasional third voice heard on the tape is that of Dr. Myron Warshaw, who assisted in the interview.